Every pain or discomfort means nothing to me as long as I can see that the experience will take me to a new level. I'm interested in the unknown, and the only path to the unknown is through breaking barriers, an often painful process. That's a process Nayette has gone through many times as she trained to break records as a long-distance swimmer. In 1979, she swam nonstop from Bimini in the Bahamas to Florida. It took her 2 days. Her record has stood for more than 30 years. The next time you find yourself in the midst of a bad experience, remind yourself that you are on the cusp of an opportunity to change and grow. Whether you do will depend on how you react to your experience and the changes you make as a result. Allow your emotions to be the catalyst for change. Think through how to change to make sure you are making good choices, and then take action. Number 5. Take responsibility for your life. Earlier I said that you need to recognize that your circumstances don't define you. They are outside of you and need not negatively impact your values and standards. At the same time, you must take responsibility for your life and the choices you make. Psychiatrist Frederick Flack in his book Resilience and psychologist Julia Seagal in Winning Life's Toughest Battles indicate that people who overcome bad experiences avoid the label of victim and take responsibility for moving forward. They don't say, "What happened to me is the worst thing in the world and I'll never be free of it." They say, "What happened to me was pretty bad, but other people are worse off, and I won't give up." They do not wallow in self-pity or ask, "Why me?" And that's a good thing because it's one short step from "why me" to "woe is me." It is nearly impossible to grow in any significant way when you don't take responsibility for yourself and your life. I remember an old song by comic singer Anna Russell that represents the attitude of many people in our culture today. "I went to my psychiatrist to be psychoanalyzed, to find out why I killed the cat and blackened my wife's eyes. He put me on a downy couch to see what he could find, and this is what he dredged up from my subconscious mind. When I was one, my mommy hid my dolly in the trunk. And so it follows naturally that I am always drunk. When I was 2, I saw my father kiss the maid one day, and that is why I suffer now, kleptomania. When I was 3, I suffered from ambivalence toward my brothers, so it follows naturally I poisoned all my lovers. I am so glad that I have learned the lesson it has taught, that everything I did that's wrong is someone else's fault." In the last few years, I've done a lot of teaching and speaking in China. On a recent trip, the participants in a conference did a values exercise where people identify their top values using a pack of cards representing various values such as integrity, independence, creativity, family, and so on. It's an exercise developed and used often by the John Maxwell Company. Thousands of people have done this activity where they pick their top 6 values, then their top 2, then their number 1. What surprised me in China was the value most identified as number 1, accountability. That says a lot about their culture. No wonder they are making such strong advances in recent years. No matter what you have gone through in your life or what you are currently going through, you have the opportunity to grow from it. It's sometimes very difficult to see the opportunity in the midst of pain, but it is there. You must be willing to not only look for it, but pursue it. As you do, perhaps the words of William Penn, English philosopher and founder of the Pennsylvania province, will encourage you. "No pain, no palm, no thorns, no throne, no gall, no glory, no cross, no crown." Applying the law of pain to your life. Number 1. Assess your attitude toward negative experiences up to this point in your life. Based on your personal history, which of the following statements best describes how you have approached failure, tragedy, problems, and challenges that have caused you pain? "I do anything and everything possible to avoid pain at all cost." "I know pain is inevitable, but I try to ignore it or block it out." "I know everyone experiences pain, so I just endure it when it comes." "I don't like pain, but I try to remain positive despite it. I process the emotion of painful experiences quickly and try to find a lesson in them." "I process pain, find the lesson, and make changes proactively as a result. Your goal should be to progress from wherever you are currently to the place where you make positive changes in the wake of bad experiences. Number two, in the past, have you used bad experiences as a springboard for using your creativity? If not, use a current difficulty to help you learn how to become more creative by doing the following. Define the problem. Understand your emotion. Articulate the lesson. Identify a desired change. Brainstorm numerous pathways. Receive others' input. Implement a course of action. Remember, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always gotten. If you want to arrive at a new destination, you need to take a new path. Number three, no insight, no matter how profound, has value to you unless it is attached to changes that you will make based on what you've learned. Personal development requires a bias toward action. Spend some time recalling the last five bad experiences you've had in your life. Write down each experience along with what, if anything, you've learned from it. Then evaluate whether you decided to make changes based on what you learned and rate yourself on how well you did at implementing those changes in your life. Once you've assessed each bad experience, give yourself a grade from A to F on how well you managed those experiences. If you haven't been an A or a B student, you need to use the steps we previously talked about to become better at the process. Chapter 9, The Law of the Ladder. Character growth determines the height of your personal growth. Doug Fireball said, "Achievement to most people is something you do. To the high achiever, it is something you are." Soon after I moved to Florida, I met Jerry Anderson. It didn't take long for us to become good friends. Jerry is a wonderful person and a very successful businessman. But he didn't start out that way. His story is a testament to how character growth determines personal growth and how personal growth leads to personal success. Ambition without guidance. Jerry grew up in Ohio, and after graduating from high school, he began working in factories as a machinist and a die maker. Though he was good at his trade, worked hard, and was successful, it wasn't enough for him. He was ambitious. He wanted to do more with his life than just spend his career in a secure job and collect a gold watch when he retired. He wanted to be a success in business. So he left his factory job and set off on a career as an entrepreneur. His first business venture involved selling precision tooling manufactured in Japan. The product was good and Jerry knew his field, but the timing of the business wasn't optimal. This was in the early 1970s. At that time, the label Made in Japan wasn't seen as positive. Though Japanese manufacturing had come a long way since the years after World War II, when the country had produced cheap goods, people in the United States hadn't yet recognized it, and they wouldn't buy the products. As a result, Jerry's first business failed. Undaunted, Jerry wanted to try again. He changed strategies. This time he became part of a network marketing venture. Hardworking and ambitious, he poured his efforts into the new business. But this time, everyone in the organization failed when the state investigated the organization and shut it down. Even after that, Jerry was still determined not to give up. By this time, he was living in California. He started a classified ad newspaper with a friend named Bernie Torrance. He also had interest in a franchise in Ohio that published a weekly real estate magazine. For 3 years, he gave the business everything he had, yet it was still failing. Around that time, Jerry went to see John Schrock, a man Bernie looked up to and partnered with in business. Jerry asked John how he managed to be successful in his business dealings. John confided to him that he based his business dealings on values and principles. "What values and principles?" Jerry asked. "These," said John, taking a small homemade book out of his jacket pocket. "It contained sayings taken from the book of Proverbs and sorted by subject." John always carried it with him. "Anytime I have a business problem or question, I go to this book to get an answer." John gave a copy of the little book to Jerry and encouraged him to use it. "To be a success, think like a success." Jerry sensed that if he were to be a successful businessman, he needed to learn how to think like a successful businessman. With that in mind, he got together 5 or 6 other people, and they committed to meet together once a week for an hour to study the principles in the little book John had given him. For the first time, he was intentional about his personal growth, and it didn't take long for his life and his business to change. The business, which had always struggled, turned around and for the first time made a profit. He expanded throughout the state of California and was so successful that the company was bought out. Jerry moved back to Ohio to be closer to John. He did some consulting for a time, but it wasn't long before he wanted to start another business. Building on what he had already learned, he began working with another real estate magazine. In time, he grew it to be the largest publication of its kind in the United States, covering real estate in cities from Chicago to Miami, and employing 1,000 employees. Eventually, a company from New York bought him out again. The principles start to spread. By the 1980s, people who had heard about John Schrock were traveling to Ohio to meet him and learn from him. John had even written about some of his ideas and principles to try to help people. In the late 1980s, Jerry decided that he wanted to take the principles John had shared with him to the marketplace, and John and Bernie agreed to try it with him because they wanted to share what they had learned with others. They traveled around the United States trying to interest business people. They found few takers. But then they crossed paths with 3 men from Guatemala, a dentist, a corporate executive, and an owner of hardware stores who were in Virginia looking for help with their businesses. When they saw the materials Jerry and his team had developed, they got excited and invited Jerry and his organization, which eventually became known as LARED, to come to Guatemala and help them. Jerry's organization visited Guatemala City, and they were successful in launching roundtable groups very similar to the one that Jerry had started in California so many years before. The groups were encouraged to set a time to meet each week, discuss a principle, along with its characteristics and benefits, evaluate themselves on where they stood in that area, and commit to taking specific action to change and improve it. The following week, they'd hold each other accountable for their commitments and then discuss the next principle. During the course of the next year, they would discuss subjects such as generosity, hard work, motives, honesty, patience, humility, dependability, and many other values that were core to the strength of a businessman's thinking. Word got out about the success of what they were doing with business people, and LARED was invited by the dean at a large university in Guatemala to teach values to the faculty, which at the time was known to take bribes and make other kinds of trades for grades. The values that were taught began to change the culture of the university, so much so that the university's board asked all the incoming freshmen to be taught the same values. Today, between 12 and 15,000 students each year go through that course. Not long after LARED was established in Guatemala, Jerry and his team were invited to Bogota, Colombia, to teach values again. They planned a launch where they expected about 50 people to show up. Instead, there were hundreds, and they had to move the meeting to a nearby city park. As word spread in Colombia, representatives from the national government asked LARED to teach the same character principles to 11,500 government employees. Jerry happily accepted. Then he found out that the employees were all prison guards. That was very intimidating. The prisons in Colombia were notoriously violent and corrupt. Incarcerated drug and guerrilla leaders built suites for themselves in the prisons and ran their operations from them. Murders were a daily occurrence, and the administrators and the guards at the prisons either went along with the corruption or were killed. But the prisons were now being overseen by a general who had been coaxed out of retirement. A man with high integrity, General Cifuentes, wanted to change the culture of the prisons, and he refused to turn a blind eye to the corruption. That determination cost the life of his son, who was mistakenly killed by hitmen who thought he was the general. And additional attempts were made on the general's life, but he survived them. He was the impetus for bringing Jerry into the prisons. Lorette introduced character development and values into 143 prisons holding 75,000 prisoners, and the culture began to change. A year and a half later, the murder rate was down dramatically, and there were reports that some of the prisoners actually said they wanted to be more like the guards. Certainly, the prisons had not become pleasant places, but they had changed, and that prompted the Colombian military to ask that Lorette begin training military troops in character development. Lorette continues to take character values and principles to businesses, governments, education, and churches around the globe. Currently, they are helping people in 44 nations. They estimate that more than 1 million people have been trained in a foundation of values-based principles. And that's important, because character growth determines the height of your personal growth. And without personal growth, you can never reach your potential. The value of character. Professors Jim Kouzes and Barry Posner have spent more than 25 years surveying leaders in virtually every type of organization in which they ask, what values, personal traits, or characteristics do you look for and admire in a leader? During those years, they have administered a survey questionnaire called Characteristics of Admired Leaders to more than 75,000 people on six continents, Africa, North America, South America, Asia, Europe, and Australia. The results they report have been striking in their regularity over the years, and they do not significantly vary by demographical, organizational, or cultural differences. And what quality is most admired in leaders? The answer is honesty. As Kouzes and Posner explain, honesty, which is the core of good character, is the quality that most enhances or damages personal reputations. They write, in almost every survey conducted, honesty has been selected more than any other leadership characteristic. Overall, it emerges as the single most important factor in the leader-constituent relationships. The percentages vary, but the final ranking does not. From the first time we conducted our studies, honesty has been at the top of the list. It comes as little surprise that people want to follow leaders of good character. No one likes to work with unreliable people. But before you or I work with any other person or follow any other leader, who do we have to rely on every day? Ourselves. That's why character is so important. If you cannot trust yourself, you won't ever be able to grow. Good character with honesty and integrity at its core is essential to success in any area of life. Without it, a person is building on shifting sand. Bill Thraw asserts that people often focus on their professional capacity without developing character, and it almost always costs them in the end. It costs them their personal relationships, and often their career. He likens it to climbing a long extension ladder that lacks the proper support. The higher a person climbs, the more wobbly and unstable it can become, until the person climbing it finally falls. Retired General Norman Schwarzkopf asserted, 99% of leadership failures are failures of character. So are 99% of all other failures. Most people focus too much on competence and too little on character. How often does a person miss a deadline because he didn't follow through when he should have? How many times do people get lower grades on tests than they could have because they didn't study as much as they should have? How frequently do people fail to grow not because they didn't have time to read helpful books, but because they chose to spend their time and money on something else that was less worthwhile? All of those shortcomings are the result of character, not capacity. Character growth determines the height of your personal growth. That's the law of the ladder. Rungs on my character ladder. Climbing the ladder of character is something that I have always had to do intentionally. It doesn't just happen for me. It probably doesn't just happen for you either. It's taken me decades to develop the right mindset and learn what rungs need to be in place in order for me to improve. Here are the five rungs on my character ladder that have empowered me to climb higher. Perhaps they will also help you to climb. Number one, I will focus on being better on the inside than on the outside. Character matters. I believe it is a normal human desire to be concerned about how we look on the outside. There's nothing wrong with that. What can get us into trouble is worrying more about how we look on the outside than about how we really are on the inside. Our reputation comes from what others believe about our outside. Our character represents who we are on the inside. And the good news is that if you focus on being better on the inside than on the outside, over time, you will also become better on the outside. Why do I say that? The inside influences the outside. More than 2,500 years ago, the Proverbs writer noted that as we think in our hearts, so we become. That ancient idea has been both echoed by other wisdom writers and confirmed by modern science. Coaches teach the importance of visualization for winning. Psychologists point out the power of self-image on people's actions. Doctors note the impact of positive attitude and hope on healing. What we believe really matters. We reap what we sow. What we do or neglect to do in the privacy of our daily lives impacts who we are. If you neglect your heart, mind, and soul, it changes who you are on the outside as well as on the inside. Inside victories precede outside ones. If you do the things you need to do when you need to do them, then someday you can do the things you want to do when you want to do them. In other words, before you can do, you must be. I have often observed people who seem to be doing all the right things on the outside, yet they were not experiencing success. When that happens, I usually conclude that something is wrong on the inside and needs to be changed. The right motions outwardly with wrong motives inwardly will not bring lasting progress. Right outward talking with wrong inward thinking will not bring lasting success. Expressions of care on the outside with a heart of hatred or contempt on the inside will not bring lasting peace. Continual growth and lasting success are the result of aligning the inside and the outside of our lives. And getting the inside right must come first, with solid character traits that provide the foundation for growth. Our inside development is totally within our control. We often cannot determine what happens to us, but we can always determine what happens within us. Jim Rohn said, "Character is a quality that embodies many important traits such as integrity, courage, perseverance, confidence, and wisdom. Unlike your fingerprints that you were born with and can't change, character is something you can create within yourself and must take responsibility for changing. When we fail to make the right character choices within us, we give away ownership of ourselves. We belong to others, to whatever gains control of us. And that puts us in a bad place. How can you ever reach your potential and become the person you can be if others are making your choices for you? The rungs on my character ladder have come as a result of hard-fought personal choices. They were not easily made, and they are not easily managed. Every day there is a battle from the outside for me to compromise or surrender them. Regretfully, there have been times when I have. But whenever that's happened, I have diligently gone after them to return them to their respectful place, inside of me." Doug Fireball, author and multi-level marketing expert, says, "Winning in life is more than just money. It's about winning on the inside and knowing that you have played the game of life with all you had and then some. If you want to be successful, you must prioritize building your inside ahead of your outside." Several years ago, teenage millionaire phenomenon Farrah Gray wrote a book called Rillionaire. He coined the term to describe someone who has discovered that there is more to money than having money. A person who understands that success is not just about being rich in your pocket. You have to be rich on the inside, too. At a tender age, he recognized that money without a strong character foundation can lead not to success but to ruin. If you have any doubt, just look at the number of famous child actors and young pop stars who have crashed and burned. Their stories are often sad because they focused on the externals of life instead of building internally to give themselves a strong foundation when fame and fortune came. Theirs is a fate we need to work hard to avoid, by focusing on improving on the inside more than on the outside. Number two, I will follow the golden rule. People matter. Several years ago, when I was asked to write a book on ethics in business, the result was Ethics 101, which I based on the golden rule. If you had to pick only one guideline for life, you couldn't do better than this. Here is a simple rule of thumb guide for behavior. Ask yourself what you want people to do for you, then grab the initiative and do it for them. Following the golden rule is a wonderful character builder. It prompts you to focus on other people. It leads you to be empathetic. It encourages you to take the high road. And if you stick to it, especially when it's difficult, you can't help but become the kind of person others want to be around. After all, in the end, in all of our relationships, we are either pluses or minuses in the lives of others. The golden rule helps us to remain a plus. Number three, I will teach only what I believe. Passion matters. Most speakers are asked early in their careers to talk about a wide variety of subjects, or they come from a particular tradition that expects them to weigh in on certain topics from a particular point of view. For example, motivational speakers are often expected to proclaim, "If you believe it, you can achieve it." When I was first starting out in my career, there were a few things I taught that I didn't buy into 100%. I'm not talking about things that are clearly right or wrong. I'm talking about subjective things that are a matter of opinion. But as soon as I spoke about them, I regretted it. Do you know what they call a speaker who teaches what he doesn't believe? A hypocrite. So early on, I vowed to teach only what I believe. And that has benefited me not only in the area of integrity, but also in the area of passion. Borrowed beliefs have no passion, therefore no power. Some of the things I was passionate about 30 years ago, such as the effectiveness of learning real relationships, equipping, attitude, and leadership, I'm still just as passionate about today. And if anything, I'm even more passionate today about the statement everything rises and falls on leadership than I was when I first communicated it to an audience. Individuals who lack principles and passion become beige people. I don't ever want to become one of those. I'll bet you don't want to either. Number four, I will value humility above all virtues. Perspective matters. Playwright and author J.M. Barrie observed, "The life of every man is a diary in which he means to write one story and writes another. And his humblest hour is when he compares the volume as it is with what he had hoped to make it." I think anyone who is honest with himself realizes that he falls short of where he could and should be in life. Unlike what Tom Hanks said as Forrest Gump, life is not a box of chocolates. It's more like a jar of jalapenos. What we do today might burn our butts tomorrow. We don't intend to make mistakes and to fall short, but we do. We're all just one step away from stupid. Author, pastor, and friend Andy Stanley says, "I've concluded that while nobody plans to mess up their life, the problem is that few of us plan not to. That is, we don't put the necessary safeguards in place to ensure a happy ending. So how do we do that?" Remember the big picture. I think the first thing to do is remind ourselves of the big picture. It's said that President John F. Kennedy kept a small plaque in the White House with the inscription, "O God, thy sea is so great and my boat is so small." If the person known as the leader of the free world can keep perspective of his true place in the world, so should we. Recognize that everyone has weaknesses. Rick Warren gives good advice about how to remain humble. He suggests admitting our weaknesses, being patient with others' weaknesses, and being open to correction. Of those three things, I have to admit that I do only one of them fairly well. I don't find it difficult to admit my weaknesses, maybe because I have so many. I have a much harder time being patient with others. I am constantly having to remind myself to extend grace to others. And in order to be more open to correction, I never assume that I will not mess up. I develop relationships with good people who will speak the truth to me, and I set up accountability systems in my life. Be teachable. I love being around people who have a beginner's mindset. They think of themselves as apprentices instead of experts, and as a result have a humble, teachable posture. They try to see things from others' perspective. They are open to new ideas. They possess a thirst for knowledge. They ask questions and know how to listen. And they gather as much information as possible before making decisions. I admire such people and try to be like them. Be willing to serve others. Few things are better for cultivating character and developing humility than serving others. Putting others first right sizes our egos and perspective. If you are a leader, then you especially need to remember this because you can get used to being served by others and come to think that you are entitled to it. In their book Winning the Answers, Jack and Susie Welch describe people who swell because of their success and as a result develop the wrong kind of attitude toward others. They write, "People who swell develop all sorts of unappealing behaviors. They're arrogant, especially toward their peers and subordinates. They hoard credit and belittle the efforts of others, don't share ideas except to show them off, and don't listen very well, if at all. Bosses can spot these team-killing behaviors a mile away, and so it is no wonder that those with power and authority around you, as you put it, have consistently worked against you. You may be very smart and deliver stellar results on the job, but your swollen personality is the kind that undermines the morale in any organization and ultimately can really damage performance." How does a person who is used to winning remind himself that it's not all about him? By serving others. For me, service starts with Margaret and the rest of my family. Also, beginning in 1997, I've selected a handful of individuals every year who I can try to serve without receiving anything in return. And I also look for ways to serve my team, since they work so hard to serve me and our vision every day. Be grateful. I am very conscious of the fact that I have been blessed and don't deserve what I've received in life. I am indebted to God and others, and because of that, I try to maintain an attitude of gratitude. That isn't always easy. Consultant Fred Smith, who mentored me for many years, helped me in this area. He said, "We do not stay grateful because that makes us indebted, and we don't want to be indebted." The biblical phrase, sacrifice of thanksgiving, was a puzzle to me until I realized that gratitude is acknowledging that someone did something for me that I could not do for myself. Gratitude expresses our vulnerability, our dependence on others. A Chinese proverb says that those who drink the water must remember those who dug the well. Everything we do, every accomplishment we have, every milestone we pass, has come in part because of the efforts of others. There are no self-made men or women. If we can remember that, we can be grateful. And if we are grateful, we are more likely to develop good character than if we aren't. Confucius asserted, "Humility is a solid foundation of all the virtues." In other words, it paves the way for character growth, and that sets us up for personal growth. These things are definitely connected. Number 5, I will strive to finish well. Faithfulness matters. The final rung on my character ladder is the determination to keep building character and living at the highest standard until the day I die. I am endeavoring to do that by doing the right thing and becoming a better person every day. To do the right thing, I don't wait to feel like it. I recognize that emotion follows motion. Do the right thing and you feel right. Do the wrong thing and you feel bad. If you take control of your behavior, your emotions will fall into place. Pastor and radio broadcaster Tony Evans says, "If you want a better world composed of better nations, inhabited by better states, filled with better counties, made up of better cities, comprised of better neighborhoods, illuminated by better churches, populated by better families, then you'll have to start by becoming a better person." That's always where it starts. With me. With you. If we focus on personal character, we make the world a better place. If we do that our entire lives, we've done the best thing we can to improve our world. The stronger your character, the greater your growth potential. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alexander Solzhenitsyn spent 8 years in prison during the Soviet era for criticizing Joseph Stalin. He went into prison an atheist and came out a person of faith. The experience didn't leave him bitter. It left him grateful for the development of his faith and the strengthening of his character. Looking back on the experience, he said, "I bless you, prison. I bless you for being in my life. For there, lying on rotting prison straw, I learned the object of life is not prospering as I had grown up believing, but the maturing of the soul." If we desire to grow and reach our potential, we must pay more attention to our character than to our success. We must recognize that personal growth means more than expanding our minds and adding to our skills. It means increasing our capacity as human beings. It means maintaining core integrity, even when it hurts. It means being who we should be, not just being where we want to be. It means maturing our souls. Physician and author Orison Swett Marden once described a successful person by saying, "He was born mud and died marble." This gives us an interesting metaphor to use to look at various lives. Some people are born mud and remain mud. Sadly, some are born marble and die mud. Some are born mud, dream of marble, but remain mud. But many persons of high character have been born mud and died marble. Isn't that a wonderful thought? I hope that can be said of me at the end of my life, and I hope the same for you. Applying the law of the ladder to your life. Number one, assess where you have put most of your focus up until this point in your life. Has it been on improving on the inside or on the outside? Here are some of the ways you can do that. Compare how much you spent in the last 12 months on clothing, jewelry, accessories, and so on, versus how much you spent on books, conferences, and that sort of thing. Compare how much time you spent in the last month on personal and spiritual growth versus activities related to appearance. If you exercise regularly, examine what benefits you are striving for. Do they relate to inner health or outer appearance? If your assessment reveals more of an outward focus than an inward one, then determine how to shift your focus by adding time, money, and attention to the things that will make you grow, even if they do not show. Number two, plan to spend time in the coming months to regularly serve others. Putting aside your own agenda and putting others first will help you to develop humility, character, and other-mindedness. Start with your family if you aren't in the habit of doing things for them. Another idea is to set aside at least an hour every week for volunteering. Schedule it, and then give it 100% of your focus while you're serving. Number three, U.S. Senator Dan Coats said, "Character cannot be summoned at the moment of crisis if it has been squandered by years of compromise and rationalization. The only testing ground for the heroic is the mundane. The only preparation for the one profound decision which can change a life or even a nation is those hundreds of half-conscious, self-defining, seemingly insignificant decisions made in private. Habit is the daily battleground of character. What are you doing every day to develop the habit of character growth? Are you giving attention to your soul? Are you doing hard or unpleasant things? Are you practicing the golden rule and putting others ahead of yourself? Your character isn't set. You can improve it. It's never too late. You can change who you are and your overall potential by becoming a better person." Chapter 10, The Law of the Rubber Band. Growth stops when you lose the tension between where you are and where you could be. W. Somerset Maugham said, "Only a mediocre person is always at his best." When I was a kid growing up, I loved sports and I was a pretty decent athlete. I discovered basketball in the fourth grade and it became my passion. I played it through high school. Like most kids in college, I was active and pretty fit. And in my 20s, I continued to play pickup basketball games with friends and added golf to my routine. But as I went further in my career and got into my 30s and 40s, I didn't exercise and take care of my health as I should have. I paid for that when I was 51 and suffered a heart attack. Since that time, exercise has been a regular part of my routine. For many years, I walked or ran on a treadmill. I sometimes run part of a golf course when playing with friends. About 5 years ago, I switched to swimming, attempting to put in an hour of exercise every day in the pool. More recently, I've been doing Pilates with Margaret. These exercises focus primarily on building core muscle strength and flexibility. To achieve that flexibility, there is an emphasis on physical stretching. We've found it to be very beneficial and rewarding. I believe I'm currently in the best shape I've been in for 35 years. A series of stretches. As I prepared to write this chapter, I was reminded of all the professional stretching I've had to do over the course of my career. One of my favorite quotes, which I collected as a teenager, says, "God's gift to us is our potential. Our gift to God is developing it." How do we do that? By getting out of our comfort zone. By continually stretching, not only physically, but also mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. Life begins at the end of our comfort zone. We go there by stretching. When I look back on the last 40 years or so, I can see that much of the progress I've had in my career has come as a result of stretching experiences. Here are some of them. Choosing my first pastorate. I went to a church where no one knew my dad, who was a district superintendent. My start was slower than it undoubtedly would have been if I'd gone somewhere Dad could have helped me. As it was, I had to work harder than I might have otherwise, and I had to find myself and learn what I was really capable of. I believe this helped me to define my career. I was determined to work hard and be creative in finding ways to lead people and grow my church. I learned so many leadership lessons in that first church, and I learned how to love people better. Focusing on teaching leadership. When I started talking about leadership in the mid-70s, it was a topic other pastors were not talking about. There were people who criticized me for focusing on what they considered a secular message, though I have to say I find that peculiar since the greatest leaders of all time can be found in the Bible. Abraham, Moses, David, Jesus, and Paul, just to name a few. Even 40 years later, some continue to criticize me for it. So why did I keep teaching it? Because pastors are required to lead people. And in my day, they received no training in leadership, even though they must do it every day of their careers. Early on, I struggled as a leader. I knew others would too. I wanted to help them. By stretching through this experience, I was not only able to help many pastors, but I was able to discover the message that I believe I was born to teach. Learning to communicate internationally. I remember the first time I spoke using an interpreter. It was in Japan. The process was uncomfortable because I had to say a phrase or two, pause for what I said to be translated, and then say a bit more, pause again, and so on. And of course, there were many cultural differences that needed to be bridged. I found it difficult. After I had finished speaking, Margaret said that our daughter Elizabeth, who was 8 years old at the time, leaned over to her at one point and said, "Dad's not very good, is he?" Even a child could tell that I was not connecting well with my audience. I enjoy communicating, and the easiest thing for me to do would have been to simply give up the idea of speaking to others outside of the United States. I had already learned how to communicate effectively in English. However, I saw this as an opportunity to stretch and grow, and maybe someday make a greater impact. It took me almost a decade to learn how to connect with people in other cultures while working with a translator, but it's definitely been worth it. That groundwork made it possible for me to start EQUIP, which now trains leaders in 175 countries around the world. Crossing over to a new audience. After I had been teaching leadership to pastors for about 10 years, I began to notice a trend. More and more business people were attending my leadership conferences. I welcomed this because I had been teaching leadership to lay people as well as staff in my own church for years. But it didn't prompt me to change what I was doing. Then one day when I was meeting with my publisher, I learned that my books were being purchased more and more through secular retailers rather than religious ones. In fact, over the course of time, it has shifted so that 2/3 of the sales were through regular retail channels. I saw this as an incredible opportunity to reach many more people than I otherwise would. But there was a challenge. Could I connect and communicate with business people? People expect one thing when they sit in a church to hear a message from a pastor. They expect something entirely different when they pay money to hear a speaker. I wasn't sure whether I would be able to succeed. It was another stretching experience. Focusing on building a legacy. When I turned 60, I was prepared to slow down. I had moved to a sunny, warm climate, which I loved. I was financially blessed. I had grandchildren, which is the most wonderful gift a person can have in this life. I would continue to speak and write, but not at the pace I had before. It was a season of harvest after decades of work. But then some opportunities presented themselves. My books were now with a new publisher. I was approached about starting a coaching company, and I had a chance to regain control of the training and development materials I had created over the previous decade. What would I do? It would mean stretching again, but I was willing to seize the opportunity and accept the challenge, and I'm so glad I did. I have entered another season of sowing instead of just harvesting. I believe it will allow me to help many more people than I would have if I had simply slowed down. The benefits of tension. Many years ago, during one of the sessions I taught at a leadership conference, I put a rubber band on the table at the place of every attendee. Then I started the session by asking about all the ways people could think of for using the rubber band. At the end of the discussion time, I asked them if they could identify the one thing all of their uses had in common. Maybe you have already guessed what it was. Rubber bands are useful only when they are stretched. That can also be said of us. Number one, few people want to stretch. There's a joke about a longtime handyman named Sam, who was once offered a full-time job by a mill owner who was having problems with muskrats at the mill's dam. The owner asked Sam to rid the mill of the pest and even provided a rifle for him to do the job. Sam was ecstatic because it was the first steady work with a regular paycheck that he had ever gotten. One day, several months later, a friend came to visit Sam. He found him sitting on a grassy bank, the gun across his knees. "Hey, Sam, what you doing?" he asked. "My job, guarding the dam." "From what?" "Muskrats." His friend looked over at the dam, and just at that moment a muskrat appeared. "There's one," the friend exclaimed. "Shoot him." Sam didn't move. Meanwhile, the muskrat scurried away. "Why the heck didn't you shoot him?" "Are you crazy?" replied Sam. "Do you think I want to lose my job?" You may think that joke is silly, but it's much closer to the truth than we may like to admit. I say that because when I was in college, one of the jobs I had was at a local meat packing plant. My job was to haul racks of meat to the refrigeration units and get orders for customers. But I was curious about the whole operation and wanted to understand how it worked. After I'd been there a couple of weeks, Pensy, a worker who had been there for many years, took me aside and said, "You ask too many questions. The less you know, the less you have to do." His job was to kill cows at the plant, and that's all he ever wanted to do. He was like the character in a Wall Street Journal cartoon I saw, who told the personnel manager, "I know I'm overqualified, but I promise to use only half of my ability." Most people use only a fraction of their ability and rarely strive to reach their full potential. There is no tension to grow in their lives, little desire to stretch. Sadly, a third of high school graduates never read another book for the rest of their lives, and 42% of college graduates, similarly, never read a book after college. And publisher David Godine claims that only 32% of the U.S. population has ever been in a bookstore. I don't know if people are aware of the gap between where they are and where they could be, but relatively few seem to be reading books to try to close it. Too many people are willing to settle for average in life. Is that bad? Read this description written by Edmond Gaudet, and then you decide. Average is what the failures claim to be when their family and friends ask them why they have not been more successful. Average is the top of the bottom, the best of the worst, the bottom of the top, the worst of the best. Which of those are you? Average means being run-of-the-mill, mediocre, insignificant, and also-ran, a non-entity. Being average is the lazy man's cop-out. It's lacking the guts to take a stand in life. It's living by default. Being average is to take up space for no purpose, to take the trip through life, but never pay the fare, to return no interest for God's investment in you. Being average is to pass one's life away with time rather than to pass one's time away with life. It's to kill time rather than to work it to death. To be average is to be forgotten once you pass from this life. The successful are remembered for their contributions. The failures are remembered because they tried. But the average, the silent majority, is just forgotten. To be average is to commit the greatest crime one can against oneself, humanity, and one's God. The saddest epitaph is this: here lies Mr. and Miss Average. Here lies the remains of what might have been, except for their belief that they were only average. I cannot stand the idea of settling for average. Can you? Nobody admires average. The best organizations don't pay for average. Mediocrity is not worth shooting for. As novelist Arnold Bennett said, the real tragedy is the tragedy of a man who never in his life braces himself for his one supreme effort, who never stretches to his full capacity, never stands up to his full stature. We must be aware of the gap that stands between us and our potential, and let the tension of that gap motivate us to keep striving to become better. Number 2. Settling for the status quo ultimately leads to dissatisfaction. I believe most people are naturally tempted to settle into a comfort zone where they choose comfort over potential. They fall into familiar patterns and habits, doing the same things in the same way with the same people at the same time and getting the same results. It's true that being in your comfort zone may feel good, but it leads to mediocrity and therefore dissatisfaction. As psychologist Abraham Maslow asserted, if you plan on being anything less than you are capable of being, you will probably be unhappy all the days of your life. If you have ever settled for the status quo and then wondered why your life isn't going the way you hoped, then you need to realize that you will only reach your potential if you have the courage to push yourself outside your comfort zone and break out of a mindset of mediocrity. You must be willing to leave behind what feels familiar, safe, and secure. You must give up excuses and push forward. You must be willing to face the tension that comes from stretching toward your potential. That is the only way to avoid what poet John Greenleaf Whittier described when he wrote, "For all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, it might have been." Number 3, stretching always starts from the inside out. When I was a teenager, my dad asked me to read As a Man Thinketh by James Allen. It had a profound impact on my life. It made me realize that reaching your potential started on the inside. Allen wrote, "Your circumstances may be uncongenial, but they shall not long remain so. If you but perceive an ideal and strive to reach it, you cannot travel within and stand still without." Most people have a dream. For some, it's on the tip of their tongue, and for others, it's buried deep in their hearts. Everyone has one. However, not very many people are pursuing it. When I teach on the subject of achieving a dream, and I ask the audience how many have a dream, nearly everyone raises his hand. When I ask how many are pursuing that dream, fewer than half raise their hands. And when the question is, how many are achieving the dream, I see only a few scattered hands being raised. What is stopping them? For that matter, what is stopping you? The authors of Now Discover Your Strengths, Marcus Buckingham and Donald O. Clifton, cite Gallup polls indicating that most people don't like their current jobs, yet they don't make a change. What's stopping them? Most Americans want to lose weight, but they don't make the effort to do so. I run across people all the time who tell me that they want to write a book, but when I ask, "Have you started writing?" the answer is almost always no. Instead of wishing, wanting, and waiting, people need to search inside themselves for reasons to start. It's wise to remember that our situation in life is mainly due to the choices we make and the actions we do or fail to take. The older we are, the more responsible we are for our situation. If you are merely average, or if you are no closer to your dream this year than you were last year, you can choose to accept it, defend it, cover it up, and explain it away. Or you can choose to change it, grow from it, and forge a new path. Jim Rohn observed, "Every life form seems to strive to its maximum except human beings. How tall will a tree grow? As tall as it possibly can. Human beings, on the other hand, have been given the dignity of choice. You can choose to be all, or you can choose to be less. Why not stretch up to the full measure of the challenge and see what you can do? Where do you find the internal impetus for stretching? Measure what you're doing against what you're capable of. Measure yourself against yourself. Make a contest of it. If you have no idea what you might be capable of, talk to people who care about you and believe in you. Don't have any people in your life who fit that description? Then go look for some. Find a mentor who can help you see yourself for who you could be, not who you currently are. And then use that image to inspire you to start stretching. Number 4, stretching always requires change. At the beginning of this chapter, I mentioned my 5 major professional stretching experiences. As I reflect upon these times in my life, I have to admit that it was a challenge to change. I didn't like it. I like being comfortable, and I'm always tempted to resist stretching. But growth doesn't come from staying in your comfort zone. You can't improve and avoid change at the same time. So how do I embrace change and kick myself out of my comfort zone? First of all, I stop looking over my shoulder. It's difficult to focus on your past and change in the present. That's why for years I had on my desk a little plaque that said, "Yesterday ended last night." It helped me to focus on the present and work to improve what I could today. That's important. Author and contributor to the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, Alan Cohen, says, "To grow, you must be willing to let your present and future be totally unlike your past. Your history is not your destiny." The second thing I do is work to develop my reach muscle. A.G. Buckham, who pioneered aviation photography in the early days of flight, observed, "Monotony is the awful reward of the careful. If you want to change and grow, you must take risk." Innovation and progress are often initiated by people who push for change. Jeopardy host Alex Trebek observed, "Have you ever met a successful person who wasn't restless, who was satisfied with where he or she was in life? They want new challenges. They want to get up and go. That's one of the reasons they're successful." It's unfortunate that the word entrepreneur has come to mean gambler to some people. But risk has advantages. People who take risk learn more and faster than those who don't. Their depth and range of experience is often greater, and they learn how to solve problems. All of those help a person to grow. The greatest stretching seasons of life come when we do what we have never done, push ourselves harder, and reach in a way that is uncomfortable to us. That takes courage. But the good news is that it causes us to grow in ways we thought were impossible. And it gives life to what novelist George Eliot said, "It's never too late to be what you might have been." Number 5, stretching sets you apart from others. America seems to be increasingly satisfied with mediocrity. Yet it isn't at its root a national problem. It's a personal concession to do less than our best. It takes an individual to say, "I guess good enough is good enough." But unfortunately, mediocrity spreads from person to person and eventually metastasizes until an entire nation is at risk. Excellence seems to be moving further and further from the norm. However, people who live by the law of the rubber band and use the tension between where they are and where they could be as impetus to stretch can distinguish themselves from their peers. Jack and Susie Welch address this issue in their book, Winning: The Answers. When a young person entering the corporate world asks, "How can I quickly distinguish myself as a winner?" they answer, "First of all, forget some of the most basic habits you learned in school. Once you are in the real world, and it doesn't matter if you are 22 or 62, starting your first job or your fifth, the way to get ahead is to overdeliver. Look, for years you've been taught the virtues of meeting specific expectations, and you've been trained that it's an A-plus performance to fully answer every question the teacher asks.